So explain how you're following this investigation. If you're somebody who watches cable news at night, or if you're following news that's a little bit more in-depth like NPR or the NewsHour, there seems to be a difference in reporting. There are reporters who are fine reporters out there who are following along, but do they have the time and the resources that you do to kind of weed through the court filings and everything else? What do you find are the differences in how you approach this investigation compared to others who are following this investigation?
Well, on investigations like this, and I also covered the CIA leak investigation that started in 2003 and went to 2007. And so on investigations like this of very prominent people where there is an investigator who actually doesn't leak, it changes the calculus for journalism. Most of the outlets you described, those editors are going to place a premium on what a human being tells you. And so in this case, and in the case of the Scooter Libby case, what a human being tells you almost always means what a self-interested defense attorney is willing to tell a reporter. And that gives you a big, and in this case, like, nobody does that more than Rudy Giuliani, right? The TV lawyer. And so if you are relying only on a bunch of defendants, possible defense witnesses who are all at some criminal exposure, you're going to get a snapshot of the investigation that is entirely unmoored from what is actually happening on the ground. And the way to balance that is to look at the court filings. I had a really interesting, I've been having an interesting back and forth with the New York Times for the last almost 2 months now, where they reported on something that was in a filing and got a source to explain it. And the source gave them an explanation that didn't correlate with what the filings did. I think we now all agree that what the source told them was also true, but what the source told them basically shifted the attention away from an August 2nd, 2016 meeting between Paul Manafort and this guy that the FBI thinks has ties to Russian intelligence earlier, to a time when it wasn't as damning, to a time when it wasn't in the context of a Ukrainian peace deal. And in fact, I think we all agree, and Mueller's office now also agrees, that both of those things happened. But the New York Times was actually even as we got more details in the subsequent court filings, the New York Times, they still haven't corrected the original one, right? But the New York Times was misreading the public documents, in part because, again, editors will say, well, documents redacted, we can't claim that it says what it says. And it's like, let me lay it out for you and let me show you how everything in these 20 pages pertains to this meeting. And yeah, we don't know precisely who they dealt the data to, but we know that it happened at the same meeting where Paul Manafort was talking basically sanctions relief.
When the president says no collusion, witch hunt, which has been uttered or typed hundreds of times. And if you believe that, what do you say?
Well, it's not collusion. I mean, one of the biggest tricks that Trump played in this whole pushback was to set the bar at collusion rather than conspiracy. Conspiracy, if Mueller charges a crime, it's going to be conspiracy. And the reason that's important, among other things, is, for example, if Trump agreed to enter into a conspiracy that included a Trump Tower deal, we know he agreed to do that. We've seen the signature on the statement of intent. He doesn't necessarily need to have signed on to GRU leaking emails, although we know that he also was, you know, applauding that, to be part of a conspiracy. Same thing with Don Jr. And so how you assess whether or not there is evidence to support that kind of criminal charge is based on whether people enter into agreements, and both Don Sr. and Don Jr. may have done it. To the level at which you would charge the president's son, who knows? That's one of the reasons it's important. The other reason it's important is, you know, what we've seen in the details, even just what we've seen in these, you know, like charging documents, is a great deal of, just as an example, this Trump Tower deal. Before the Iowa caucuses began, Michael Cohen had gotten on the phone with the personal assistant of one of Putin's top assistants, so two steps removed from Vladimir Putin, and said, we want this deal. We're okay to do it with the people we're working with, which included somebody who had ties to the intelligence agency that hacked Hillary Clinton. And we're okay to do it with either a soft sanction bank that could legally do it, or even a bank that's been involved in Crimea, which we technically couldn't legally do unless we overturned sanctions. We're good to do that. So before any voter in the United States cast their first vote, Putin had compromising information on Donald Trump. And it doesn't matter whether Donald Trump and Michael Cohen had no criminal intent, and there's no reason to believe they did at that point. It still creates a problem because it still means that the president of Russia has something on the president of now, on the president of the United States. And the fact that Trump has gone to great lengths to hide all of that, that's what Michael Cohen's guilty plea with Mueller was about, was Trump's efforts, which yesterday he said involved Trump's own defense attorney, Trump's efforts to shorten that time frame so it didn't extend past the Iowa caucuses, but in fact, we know it did.
What did you make of yesterday's public testimony? Because Cohen was not part of the campaign team.
No, but he was definitely involved in pushing back against the press. I mean, one of the interesting details he described is that after the Access Hollywood tape came out, he was in London at the time, and Hope Hicks called him and said, we need you to go and push this line with the press. There's nothing criminal involved with him responding to, you know, this damaging video coming out. But it is a testament to how they used him through the entire campaign to push back against really damaging allegations in the press. And he wasn't part of the White House. The one place where I think Republicans may damage Cohen going forward is he said, I didn't want to rule in the White House. And you know, hundreds of Republicans were tweeting and emailing and saying, I know that's not true. He told me. Cohen said, well, I had a lawyer come in with me and explain to the president that he needed a personal lawyer to deal with other things. You will see what happens. That I think is the most damaging thing that happened to Cohen yesterday. But yeah, he remained involved in trying to, you know, a fixer, right? The president had a fixer, and he remained that fixer for some time after the election.
Knowing what you know from going through court filings, how much was exposed yesterday and how much was not?
Nothing. I mean, you know, there's the Don Jr. talking about a meeting. That's not solid evidence, and Mueller would never rely on Cohen to present that in court, just because he will be easily damaged, you know, if in a courtroom setting. He is far more credible on the Trump Tower stuff because he's got receipts. Like, literally, he's got all of this documentation and all of these texts. And, you know, his testimony, the important part of his testimony, but we knew that. We learned that in December. The one new detail on the Russian stuff, aside from Jay Sekulow and Abby Lowell being involved in Michael Cohen's statement, which is really damaging from an obstruction standpoint. It means that, Trump had a meeting there, right? So it means that Trump's own lawyers are cooperating and formulating lies. We knew that too. We knew that with Don Jr.'s testimony on the June 9th meeting. That's true of Mike Flynn's testimony. But now we've got a third instance where we know the lawyers were actually involved in crafting the story. The one tiny detail that was new yesterday was the Roger Stone one, that he sat in on a speakerphone call where Stone said, you know, emails are coming in a couple of days, and he was right. Mueller didn't tell it. Mueller, in Stone's indictment, had phrased that as Stone told senior campaign officials in June and July details about what were coming with regards to the emails. He didn't tell us that one of those senior campaign officials was the candidate, which makes it a little more interesting. Trump's response, let's hope that happens, also interesting. You know, Cohen suggested that Mueller has some corroboration for that. Also interesting. But we still don't know who all Stone was using as a go-between with WikiLeaks. And I suspect that will come out in Stone's prosecution, which may take 6 months before it gets started.
there are reports that we're getting closer to the end, and yet there are still some sealed indictments out there. There's still some loose ends. What's still dangling in the court system before we might hear something?
We don't know of any sealed indictment that we can point to as a Mueller indictment. The Washington docket, they seal more readily than other dockets in general. There are some that are of interest. We should expect that both Felix Sater and George Nader were operating under some kind of cooperation deal, especially Sater, because, you know, he was intimately involved in this, to the extent that there was a conspiracy. So we could see his plea that probably dates back over a year, and there might be some interesting details in a sentencing memo there. We are waiting on three that we know of. One is Mueller is still trying to get the testimony of a Roger Stone associate named Andrew Miller, who appealed a subpoena based on a challenge to Mueller's authority, which was frivolous from a legal standpoint, but nevertheless is working its way through the courts. The D.C. Circuit just rejected that appeal. It's unclear whether Miller's going to ask for the full D.C. Circuit to review it or whether he's going to immediately appeal to Supreme Court. He said he was going to. So we'll see whether we get his testimony. His lawyer was told in the wake of Stone's indictment that they still need his testimony. And his lawyer has suggested that they think there's a superseding indictment out there for Roger Stone. So that's one thing. The other one is what is often called by people who are covering this closely, the mystery appellant. And this is even more interesting. It's a foreign-owned company that had an effect in the United States, also was subpoenaed by Mueller last summer, and it appealed, this is the really frightening thing, it appealed making the argument that they were a foreign country rather than a foreign-owned company. And one example that people think might be the likely candidate is Qatar and the Qatar Investment Fund, or it's QIA, so I forget what the A is. And so Qatar QIA invests in, for example, a lot of Silicon Valley firms. They're just basically a bank that is owned by the government of Qatar. They're not Qatar, though. Whoever the mystery appellant is, their lawyers are making the argument that the only way you can sanction them for not playing along in a legal prosecution in this country is to have the president impose sanctions on them. But they've been subpoenaed, of course, in an whoever it is, it may not be QIA, they've been subpoenaed in an investigation in which the president is a subject of the investigation. And so it's actually this may be the equivalent of Nixon, U.S. v. Nixon, when the Supreme Court ruled that the president actually could be investigated. It's a kind of spin of that. The argument is that the president or somebody in his family hid their criminal activity by working through a foreign-owned company and thought they'd get away with it, and the foreign-owned company is trying to play along. One of the really interesting details about that is that the very, very, very conservative Solicitor General, Noel Francisco, is the only name on the government's response to that Supreme Court challenge, even though we know that some of Mueller's lawyers wrote that brief. We don't know what that means, but it is highly unusual not to have everyone who was involved in a Supreme Court brief to put their names on it. It's as if Francisco is saying, the entire DOJ stands by this. I stand by this. DOJ believes that this is an important case to win, and I'm going to cover Mueller's people. I'm going to cover the lawyers both in D.C. and on Mueller's team who are making this argument. I'm going to take the hit to make this legal argument before the Supreme Court. And, you know, maybe part of that is meant to impress people like John Roberts, who, you know, to get the Republicans to understand the gravity of this challenge. But the mystery appellant submitted their reply brief last night, so Supreme Court could act on it or not act on it any time. And that is one of the last shoes to drop. The one other thing is that it sounded like Mueller wanted to charge Jerome Corsi, who's, you know, this conspiracy theorist who was also involved in Stone stuff, but they needed a hard copy of his book, and that doesn't come out until midway through March. So other than that, I think the claims that Mueller is done, I think I have no reason to doubt that. You know, it feels like they're just waiting for a few things to drop, and then, you know, maybe we will get news next week.
What is your suspicion in the value of this mystery appellate?
Well, I've argued that it looks like Mueller is moving towards a quid pro quo allegation, whether it's in a report or a conspiracy indictment, I have no idea. You know, the Russians dangled a real estate deal to get a meeting where they said, we want sanctions relief and we'll give you dirt to help win. There were multiple iterations of this. You know, again, in August, Trump's campaign manager did the same thing. He's like, I'll give you our polling data so you can help us and you can pitch sanctions relief on Ukraine. So that happened over and over again. Michael Flynn, before they were president, went to Russia and said, hold off on responding to Obama's new sanctions. We'll take care of it. There's very good reason to believe that he did that at Trump's order, on Trump's, you know, on Trump's direction. So you've got this quid pro quo, real estate and dirt in exchange for sanctions relief. You've got Trump moving on the sanctions relief. The question is whether there was any financial payoff to somebody in Trump's family. I said earlier that QIA, the Qatar Investment Fund, might be a candidate because they actually did bail out Jared Kushner's Albatross real estate building at 666 Fifth Avenue. And they now claim, golly, we didn't know that we were bailing out the president's son-in-law. So that is another reason why people think that it might be a candidate. If Jared Kushner got bailed out on a pass-through from Russia as part of this election deal, then you are literally the president receiving a bribe. And there are two things that are named in the Constitution to go after the president to impeach him on top of, you know, high crimes and misdemeanors. The Constitution explicitly names both bribery and treason. And if the president actually received a bribe, then we'd be on, you know, on different territory. I don't know if that's what it is, but certainly that's the kind of avenue, you know, actually that's the role that Eric Prince had in this, allegedly had in this whole controversy, is that he was at a meeting in early 2017 with the Russian Development Investment Fund and lied about it to Congress. And that was supposed to be a back channel with Russia that Eric Prince had a personal role in. And we, you know, who knows what he's up to? Who knows? But yeah, there are reasons to believe there was a payoff. And we just don't know what that was or whether Mueller can prove it. And it may depend on Mueller winning this mystery appellant challenge.
So what is your sense of where this ends up? I don't know if you want to share. No. You have your suspicions of where this is heading.
Oh, I mean, look, I do think that there is a lot of evidence supporting a claim that there was a conspiracy. I don't know whether Mueller will charge it. I know that Don Jr. has never testified. There are people like Don Jr. out there that have not testified and would be key participants in any conspiracy. We're also, I think, in a window now where William Barr, the new attorney general, hasn't passed, as far as we know, his ethics review. So Rod Rosenstein, who's been protecting this investigation for 2 years now, or not quite, but where he is probably back to doing the day-to-day supervision of Mueller, so they can, you know, they can implement whatever plan that they had wanted to implement to roll this out. I will say this, that when they did the sentencing memo for Paul Manafort in D.C. last week, they had the opportunity to lay out details about this August 2, 2016 meeting, which is very damning. They chose not to do that, even though in every other instance, they've chosen to be very forthright about the details they have. So one way or another, Mueller wants to tell that story and believes he can tell that story. I don't know how he plans to do it. I don't know, you know, I know how HJC would imagine getting stuff shared from Mueller if in fact he felt stuff needed to be shared. The idea would be that Mueller could have the grand jury vote to share grand jury information with HJC, which would lead any kind of impeachment inquiry. But if Mueller did roll out a conspiracy charge indictment, it would be easier to do because you know, it would be clear that the president was a co-conspirator, but could not be indicted because he's a sitting president.
Don Jr. has not been interviewed by the Mueller team?
No.
Why not?
Well, I mean, some lawyers will say that if somebody's a target, you don't interview them before the grand jury. It's not nice. And a lot of people say the fact that, I mean, Roger Stone was one of the other key people who was not interviewed by Mueller. And guess what? He's now facing, you know, he's facing trial. So make of it what you will. I mean, I want to emphasize to listeners that Mueller is not going to charge somebody if he doesn't have something like 85% certainty that he can get a conviction. He is definitely not going to charge the president's son if he's not 85%, 90% sure he's going to get a conviction. Actually, one of the prosecutors on the Scooter Libby case said, after reviewing Roger Stone's indictment for false statements, he said, "I've never seen a false statement case this rock solid." And I would expect Mueller not to charge a conspiracy involving the president's family unless he can reach a similar level of evidentiary certainty, just because the stakes of doing so are too high. So I don't know what he's going to do, but I know there's a ton of evidence that there was this kind of quid pro quo.
Do you have a big whiteboard in your office somewhere?
Everyone asks me that. No. You know, the fact that I write so often, my whiteboard is my, you know, I can go backstage on my site and pull up every post I've ever written. And once I've written something, I know that I've said it, you know, and I'm like, well, I think it was this post, and I can pull it up. And that's I think, one of the benefits of working iteratively is I can go back and say, oh, this detail that we learned a year ago is really important now that we know this new detail, and then I'll write a new post about it. That's how I'm so prolific. I just keep rewriting stuff I've already written. Whether or not Mueller will ever charge a conspiracy, there were a lot of players who were involved, and a lot of, you know, I think one of the most compelling arguments against a conspiracy is that Russia kept having to try new people to get through to Trump. We'll see. You know, we'll see whether that is actually the case or whether the Russians, I mean, one of the things the Russians did is as they were heading towards the election, I think they, you know, there's a story about them trying to compromise Hope Hicks in January of 2017. People should not make light of this. This is not about Trump being a bad guy. It's about a foreign country trying to compromise our own. So whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, it is important to understand the impact of what would happen if Russia were successful at compromising somebody like Hope Hicks with her access to the White House. Because none of that's good. The implications of that, none of that's good. And, you know, I think Russia invested an awful lot in this election year operation and did more than people understand at this point. And again, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, that should concern you deeply, because they did grave damage, not just to the electoral process in the United States, but to the United States. And hopefully, wherever Mueller goes, we can move forward with both sides agreeing that that's important.
Independent journalist Marcy Wheeler, thank you so much.